Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
And hello, hello, hello to my wonderful audience. I have a real treat for myself today in that I'm going to be having on my dear friend, my partner in many ways, Pam Popper. I'll be talking with her in a few minutes. I think you're there already, Pam, aren't you?
I am here.
Oh, I'm so glad you are there. I can't tell the audience how grateful I am that you are there. But I may try to say a little bit about how grateful I am. And there's a few different things I want to talk about with folks as we get started, to my great and wonderful listening audience who is just so devoted to justice and principle and to standing up to oppressive authority, and in regard to psychiatry, promoting what's really good for folks, which is other folks, not drugs, not psychiatrists, but other folks. And those folks can be a family, they can be ministers and priests, they can be peers, they can be well-trained therapists, they can be family therapists, they can be all kinds of folks who actually understand that helping people with emotional problems is all about relationships. We get to be who we are through relationships. We survive or don't on the basis of relationships. We need inner strength, but that also comes built in from relationships. Well, folks, I have been under a lot of attack again. And it's always scary in the beginning. And then it reminds me that I'm having an effect. I mean, I don't get attacked except that I'm having an effect. Now, who am I having an effect on right now? Well, it's hard to know exactly, but the spearhead has been the district attorney who so heavily prosecuted and, I believe, maligned Michelle Carter, the 17-year-old at the time, accused of telling her boyfriend to go into his car filled with carbon monoxide to die. She's been convicted of manslaughter on that basis, but the judge was very lenient afterward in the sentencing her to only 15 months in a milder setting, a house of corrections, when the DA wanted her to have, I think it was, 7 to 12 years or 10 years, something like that, in state prison. A very, very fragile young lady with a lot of medical problems, emotional problems. Very caring human being, Michelle Carter. Many, many, many people over the years felt grateful to be her friend because she's such a loving and caring person. Well, after my second series in my blog on Michelle Carter, along with my putting up my Michelle Carter archives, the DA literally tried to get a judge, the original judge in the case, to do a pre-publication censorship of me, something that's very, very radical, unheard of pretty much except if the government goes to, say, the New York Times and says, don't tell them we're mining Haiphong or something like that, don't give away secrets in warfare. The judge hasn't rendered his final opinion yet, but I don't think he'll go along with that. But I don't know what may be laying down the road, because this DA has lots of stuff to hide about this trial, about this very personal destruction they've attempted at Michelle Carter. And curiously, on a First Amendment basis, words she spoke, or did she speak them? You got to read my blogs to find out. My third blog is out today. Please, please read it. And my fourth blog is going to deal specifically with she even say these words? Hey, what's going on here? What's going on in this trial? And you do me a service by reading these blogs. I don't ever ask for anything like, you know, I don't say go out and do me a favor and read my books or anything that costs money. The blogs are free. They're up on Madden America. Bless Madden America for being there. You can get to them through my website, Bregan.com, through my frequent alerts or through Madden America. The first one, we've had 30,000 people look at it. So this is a big deal. But they attacked her freedom of speech, at least what she may have said. And now they're attacking my freedom of speech with this preemptive prevention of my publishing. Well, I'm going ahead. I took some time off to let the judicial process go. And when the judge didn't finally give out the final opinion, I decided I have to go on with publishing. So this is some of the best writing and best information I've ever put out. So please, please, please take a good look at that, at those materials. Now, as we go to talk to Pam Popper, there's lots of more exciting stuff going on. I'm just revving up for the next decade, folks. And Pam is a really big part of what's going on with me. And I think I'll tell you just a few more words about her. Pam was a major person behind and participated in what is a very famous movie called Forks Over Knives. Now that I've started to talk to my patients about nutrition, because I've learned so much from Pam, it's so consistent with everything that I know and have studied. And this movie, lots of people have seen. It's really worth your seeing. And she's written a book to go. That's kind of a development out of Forks Over Knives, which is Food Over Medicine. Great stuff. She's the head of the Wellness Forum Health, and you can find her easily on the internet. There are not a lot of Pam Poppers. I don't know why she doesn't talk about the Pam Popper program. I mean, you could make a great logo out of that with three P's and all that, but, you know, she goes her own way, I guess. But I'd do that, the Pam Popper program. Pam, God bless. So I'm glad to hear you laughing and smiling on the other side end of the line. Pam, tell me and tell the folks about our new course that's coming out. Pam has enabled me to do this monster course on with like going to have about 30 videos of me talking about how and why and how to stop taking psychiatric drugs. It's a full course with reading and with all these videos of me. So she's created an archive of Peter Bregan talking about not just that limited issue of drug withdrawal, but why to withdraw from drugs and then how to withdraw from drugs. And it gets into therapy issues, gets into love issues, it gets into life issues. It's a wonderful course, and it does give you the tools needed for psychiatric drug withdrawal. So Pam can tell you more about that. She's kind of in charge of what I'm doing with it, to say the least. And then I'm co-sponsoring her next conference. And she's enabled me to bring Peter Goetze over, one of the most amazing, wonderful people in the world, who's written amazing books like Deadly Psychiatry. I mean, he's just terrific. And the conference is going to be in November, that weekend of November 11th, and she can tell you more about that and how to find out about the course. And so we have a lot to talk about today. And don't worry, I'm going to have Pam on a couple more times before the course. You're going to get to know her very well. And I believe that knowing Pam Popper can change your life, because it is just on the basis of nutrition, it has totally improved my life and my wife's life. We are both just much, much healthier. She's recovering from some severe, painful nutritional, we didn't think they were nutritional, painful medical disorders, including ulcerative colitis with shifting joint pains or shifting joint pains. She's free of, for the first time in years and years. She's her full self for the first time in years and years. And it's just after 2 months on the sensible diet You can learn about it from Pam Popper's website, but maybe she can give you a really good link or a good way to get to the best information about it. And I've lost 25 pounds, and I don't use blood pressure medicine anymore, and I don't use another medicine anymore, and I'm probably the only 81-year-old in upstate New York who's only on one med, and I'm planning to get off of that. And that's Pam's doing. God bless you, Pam. Welcome again to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour, my friend Pam.
Thank you. Thank you. You know, I was laughing because when you were talking about the Pam Popper program, you know, Pam Popper is a name that you hate, that you have when you're in the fourth grade. I mean, kids make fun of you. And then later on, like, it becomes a really easy name to remember. I'm glad I have that name now. So, yeah, you can do a lot with Pam Popper. Sometimes people call the office and they ask for Dr. Poppins. And they get the Popper part wrong. Kelly says I'm out flying my umbrella, so I can't come to the phone right now. But anyway, it's good to be with you. Very good to be with you.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to a lot of the things we want to talk about. To start with, let's talk some about the course, because people could start planning for it. You're going to hear at the course from my organizational end. You'll hear Peter Breggin. You've heard of him, the Conscience of Psychiatry. You're going to hear from Peter Gerze, who is the founder of the Corcoran Research Group from Denmark. He's just an amazing researcher. Now he's turned his attention to psychiatry. He's become appalled and is writing and researching and speaking about it. And you'll hear from a third person that I'm bringing in, Jeannie Lenzer, who is really a world expert on the whole concept of relationship, attachment, going back to evolution of it and to the importance of the mother-infant relationship. And she gets a lot of flack for standing up for the importance of mother-child relationships in nursing. Pam gets a lot of flack for standing up against the agribusiness people. And, of course, I get a lot of flack from so many people, I can't count them, including the psychopharmaceutical people. And, of course, Peter Gerze is getting a lot of flack. So we all come in our flack vests, and we're going to just give you, you know, four great experienced presenters about an interaction of issues around what's the matter with psychiatry and what's good about relationship-based therapies, which I call empathic therapy. So, and Pam, what's your end of the conference going to be, and how can people find out about it?
Yeah, so we have some other speakers too. The big theme of the conference is informed medical decision making. And you and I were talking about this earlier today, that what's wrong with psychiatry is wrong with internal medicine, endocrinology, obstetrics, cardiology, name of practice specialty, and it's all the same thing. The evidence is not followed when making recommendations to patients, and patients get hurt every day. And so the theme is informed medical decision-making, lots about the psychiatry, psychology, mental health piece. But Dr. Richard Ablin is coming back, repeat appearance. He's sort of like you, audience demand. So, you know, people saying, please, please bring this guy back. So Richard Ablin is the researcher who discovered prostate-specific antigen, and that's PSA. It's not a marker for cancer. It is, he said, I would have called it prostate cancer-specific antigen if it was. But, of course, as you know, all men get PSA tests, and if the PSA is high, they're told they need biopsies. And he estimates that about 1 million men have had a prostatectomy in the United States who didn't qualify for one. And this is horrific. It's just horrific. And he has a lot of things to say about not only this issue, but he's going to talk about immunotherapy, which could be very helpful, but it's not being used in the right way. Dr. Janice Stanger is going to talk about nutrition and aging, how to slow the clock down. You're sort of doing that. You and Ginger are going backwards now. If you keep going in this direction, you're going to have to move back in with somebody's parents if you keep reversing the clock the way that you're going. But anyway, she's going to talk about aging and nutrition. And Eileen Kopsaftis is going to show people how to get rid of pain, musculoskeletal, back pain, knee pain, shoulder pain, without drugs and surgery, which usually don't help much anyway. And So it's a pretty big all-star lineup of people who are pretty fascinating. Oh, and Dee Anthony from Food Choices. My most recent film is Food Choices. And Dee Anthony, if any of you saw it on Netflix, is the guy that had the 2-pound tumor wrapped around his ribs and his heart. It was inoperable, and it was a death sentence. And he changed his diet and changed his thinking also, and it disappeared. So the tumor that was supposed to kill him is gone. And he has a great story to tell. His life story is definitely worth hearing. So he's there for motivation. His story is amazing, but he's there to motivate people. The others are there to give factual information. And meals are included. It's a spectacular weekend. I mean, you've spent these weekends with us before. You leave changed. You're not the same person when you leave that you were when you showed up. So to find out more, you go to wellnessforumhealth.com. And there's a little section on the front page that says, what's new? And there's a link right to the conference site. And there's a video that you and I did when you were in Columbus that talks about the conference and also lists the speakers in their bios. And I think it's hard to read this and not want to be in Columbus with us on November 10th through 12th.
Let me tell folks a little bit about Eileen, the physical therapist, sweet Pam, my friend here, Pam Popper, sent Eileen from Albany to Ithaca to treat me for pain that I had from a combination of an auto accident several years ago that cracked my L3, as I recall. I could be off a little bit here. And then a recent fall, just a few months ago, that cracked my next one, my L4. And so I had some pain that was interfering with comfortable walking. And Eileen did a diagnostic of moving my arms and legs and watching me walk and concluded that there was a simple exercise that was going to help my right leg, that where the major problem was. And within that day, it started to get better. And I continue the exercise a little bit a day for about a week or two, and it's gone. And I'm not walking with all the discomfort I had from the fall. Now, a chiropractor had helped some, but not enough, and I'd stopped seeing him about it. And then, I mean, she just really helped me a lot. So I'm having very little of any symptoms from those two compression fractures of low in my spine, right where all the nerves are coming out to the legs and so on. So this is real stuff, and I'm not easily influenced. You know, I'm not easily a placebo person. I went through the 60s, you know, when they'd say, hey, sugar's so bad for you, hold it in your arm and extend your arm and I'll be able to bend it. And whereas I can't bend it if there's no sugar in it, all this kind of nonsense. And of course, they still couldn't bend my arm with the sugar in it because I had quite a bit of confidence the sugar wasn't going to affect my arm strength. So, I mean, I come out of a long tradition of not accepting any nonsense. And Pam doesn't offer nonsense. You know, she has good foods you can eat if you want, but I'm not buying anything from Pam to do her diet at all. The diet Pam is very proud of can easily be done on food stamps. I mean, that knocks your socks off. She's not selling expensive things to people other than, you know, things she's made and cooked and developed if you want them. But Ginger, who does not cook much, there's enough for she and I to be on Pam's diet. So, and Pam isn't pushing something that's, quote, going to change your neurotransmitters or treat your depression. Pam's the real deal. She's kind of very much like me. I think you're the conscience of nutrition. How about that? I think you're the conscience
Thank
of nutrition.
You.
God bless.
Well, we both together are the, I guess we could call this all the conscience of medicine, because what you just brought up about the pain that you were experiencing, this is how orthopedic surgeons take advantage, just like you talk about psychiatrists and what they do. What orthopedic surgeons do is they look at images of your joints and then they tell you, see, this is out of line and this disc is bulging and this joint over here is degrading. And the images really don't have much to do with what that's causing the pain. And just to go, that goes to the point, there was a study done a couple of years ago where people who had no pain agreed to have their joints x-rayed. And then those x-rays were given to orthopedic surgeons. And what the orthopedic surgeons were told is to examine the x-rays and determine which patients needed surgery. They all did. You take a few hundred pain-free people, you give their images to orthopedic surgeons, and everybody qualifies for surgery. All right, this is ludicrous, right? So the key is, it doesn't matter, like I said before, what practice specialty we're talking about. The no-nonsense, how about we just filter everything through an evidence filter that we can all agree on, what constitutes good evidence, usually points away from most of what traditional medicine has to offer. Frankly, I think that the place for traditional medicine is for emergency and trauma and accidents and certain congenital conditions. And, you know, it's a pretty narrow slice of what goes on in healthcare. And then the rest of the stuff is solvable through other and much better means.
Pam, your best source of information, I think, am I right, is your book, Food Over Medicine?
Well, that's a good way to find out. I think the first thing people have to do is shift their thinking, and I think that book definitely shifts people's thinking. And then one of the services that we provide, I mean, the reason people become members at Wellness Forum Health is we can teach them how to read the medical literature so that they can start to see the stuff for themselves, and how they, and also the how-tos of adopting a health-promoting diet and lifestyle. A lot of people try to do this on their own, and without some specific instruction, they make mistakes. Not because they're stupid, it's because, like anything else, you have to be shown what to do. And most of us grew up not really thinking that diet made much of a difference. I mean, I didn't think it did. I certainly didn't eat a health-promoting diet. So if you're not taught to do this, you know, we're taught to do a whole lot of other things, but not this. So somebody giving you a blueprint helps a lot. So you can go to wellnessforumhealth.com and you can see descriptions of membership options and all that sort of thing.
Do you ever talk about the specific diet on the air, or do you prefer to?
Sure. No, I'm happy to talk about it. It's a simple diet. As you mentioned, it's simple and it's inexpensive. And that's the good news, because so much of what people eat right now is very expensive. The standard American diet is actually pretty expensive. So humans are designed to live on a plant-based diet. It doesn't have to be vegan. I mean, I eat a vegan diet, but it doesn't have to be vegan for most people anyway. But it does need to be plant-based, which means most of the calories are coming from, first of all, starchy foods like potatoes and squashes and whole grains and legumes and split peas and lentils, foods like that, and then vegetables and fruit. And then everything else takes a huge back seat. It's best if you avoid all dairy, if you avoid the oil. If you're going to eat animal foods, eat them two or three times a week. Doesn't really matter which type, as long as it's not dairy. It's much more important that the animal food be organic, because animal food is laden, including fish, laden with antibiotics at this point in time. It's dangerous to consume non-organic animal food or non-wild-caught fish. And we tell people, listen, it's okay to have cake. It's okay to have cookies and treats and things like that, but they're treats and they're for special occasions. I mean, my office is full every afternoon because people treat themselves, you know, five times a day instead of twice a month. So this is not the stuff you have in your house and munch on all the time. This is holiday food. And that's basically it. The meals are pretty easy to put together. As I mentioned, it can be very inexpensive. Walmart, if somebody shops at Walmart, everything you need to do this diet is in Walmart. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but there are very few things our government does a good job of. But one thing they've done that I really like is that if you are on food stamps, if you're using SNAP money, if you buy vegetables, you get two for one. So if you show up at the farmer's market with $20 worth of food stamps, you get to leave with $40 worth of food. And the farmer's markets are starting to take food stamps now. Almost all the ones in central Ohio do. So that's basically it. Now, the fine points of the diet that people get concerned about are, what about protein, and do I need to take supplements, and how much fat should I eat? And, you know, somebody told me coconut oil is a magical food. And, you know, all those types of questions are why you probably want some guidance doing this. But And that's the basic deal. And humans have lived on a diet like this for a very long time, millions of years, and the healthiest people on the planet still do. This is a statement that shocks people, but you know, 69% of the Okinawan diet is sweet potatoes. Most people think it's fish. Those people don't eat much fish. They eat a lot of sweet potatoes.
Me too.
So that's it.
Now.
When they're great food.
Is this okay? I put a little honey on my sweet potato yesterday. It was delicious.
I know. And cinnamon is good on sweet potatoes.
So the honey's
really
okay,
rocks.
Even though it's good tasting?
Yeah. And I'll tell you another thing you can do with sweet potatoes. I mean, I like this. Everybody else might not. But I bake, I'll slice up sweet potatoes and bake them on a cookie sheet. And then you can take the sliced sweet potatoes and put a little tablespoon of salsa on top of each one. Oh, my God. It's like a beautiful hors d'oeuvre. It looks gorgeous if you just want something that has presentation value. And it's very tasty.
Let me tell you, folks, I'm doing this diet in – it's not really a diet. It's a way of living that's natural, that is evolutionarily sound. And but I'm doing it also gluten-free, because that was the very first dietary thing I ever did, and it helped me a lot. So I'm doing it gluten-free, and I can't tolerate onion or garlic. So imagine doing a vegetable-based diet without what's in almost every one of these things, if you buy them in any prepared way at all, which is not necessarily a good idea. I mean, to do it without garlic and onion is really hard, but I've gotten really used to it. I mean, I get more pleasure out of sitting down in front of a sweet potato now than I used to get out of a fried chicken. I really do believe.
I did not interrupt you, but I think this is important. You just made a very important comment that I think people should know about when you said you like sitting down to a sweet potato more than you like the way that you ate before. And that's due to something called neuroadaptation. And what that means is that every creature on the planet grows to like a new food within a very specific period of time. And the reason for that is that our survival depended upon it. Even fruit flies. A fruit fly will prefer a different food within 45 minutes. They don't live very long. With humans, it takes a few weeks. But the bottom line is whatever you eat, that will become the preferred food. And so people think, oh, my gosh, I'm going to have to just white-knuckle this, and I'm going to sit there, and I'm going to want a steak, and I'm going to want eggs, and I'm going to sit there and eat sweet potatoes and salad and hate it. That's really not the way it turns out, as you're seeing. At some point in time, you just do this shift, and one day you wake up and you say, I love sweet potatoes, and I really don't want a steak, and eating salad doesn't bother me. I like that better.
You know, this has gone so far with me, folks, that when I watch the TV ads now, I feel as revolted by the hamburgers with the mayo and all the junk on them on the TV as I do by the ads for the psych drugs. I mean, I look at it and I say, we're poisoning ourselves, not just with the psych drugs, but with the food we eat. Pam, do you have on your website your blue triangle that's the food pyramid?
No, we don't. That's in our textbook. And so when people become members, we send them a kit that has a textbook in it. Then you get access to this online platform with videos and another platform that is specific to this, how we teach the diet. And then another platform that has, I don't know, about 125 or 30 videos on it. And we do live instruction with it. So if you live in Columbus, you can come to our office. If you live outside of Columbus, which most of our people do, we teach this via virtual classroom. That's how we teach a lot of our programs, so that it's live instruction, but you don't all have to be in the same room. So that's how people learn about it.
Let me just very quickly, for those people who, unlike me, are visual. I'm not very visual. I'm verbal, logical. Just what it looks like, because it's interesting to me. The base of the triangle, the first recommendation is at least 64 ounces of filtered water a day. And later, in a few minutes, I'd like to hear where that comes from scientifically. Then the first base for the foods is legumes and whole grains and potatoes, squash, and corn. So backward corn, squash, potatoes, whole grains, legumes, and the legumes are beans. Is split peas and lentils, are those legumes? Or split peas?
They're related to the legume family.
Legume family. So that's your base. And so I may have two potatoes a day. I may have a baked potato, regular white potato, and I might have a baked sweet potato. or I might have some squash or corn. Then the next step up, so that's your base, corn, squash, potatoes, whole grains, legumes. And then the next step up is vegetables, either raw or steamed, big salads, sprouts, and kind of an odd one sitting in there that I want to ask you about, which is green tea. So the next level up above these very basic foods that people have lived on forever the vegetables, and then then fruit. So fruit is not as central to this diet as those very basic things, including the potatoes and squash and corn and the vegetables of various kinds, including sprouts and big salads, then fruit. And then you get into processed things, and that becomes minimal, like cereals and breads and processed grains. And then as you get near the more or less forbidden stuff, like Pam calls it candy, you get into, believe it or not, anything fatty. This is a very low-fat diet. Pam considers fat to be an inflammatory agent. We can talk about that. So I got three things I want to talk to you about. Inflammatory agent. And so she says, you know, look out for nuts and seeds and olives and avocados and nut butters. So those are like my favorite things. I was made of the 25 pounds I lost was probably peanut butter with a little avocado and olives thrown in and some nuts thrown in. So as you get to the top, you see that was my big issue. And then above, as a part of that, you know, you don't eat dairy. So that was another big issue. I had to give up dairy. So we're looking at really giving up a lot of fatty stuff and dairy, because human beings didn't eat dairy until 10,000 years ago, and some never ate it. We didn't adapt to eat dairy, and we didn't have access to a lot of fatty foods. You know, nowadays, if you want an animal that's not fatty to eat, you find somebody who can sell you a chunk of venison or buffalo, because, you know, the wild animals were not all that fat, or most of them wouldn't have survived. They were only fat for times when they were storing fat. And then wild-caught fish and organic foods, optional, but no dairy, optional 2 or 3 times a week. And I do that, folks. I have chicken soup that Ginger makes me with rice and lots of veggies and or some organic chicken breast in it. And that's my main source of that. And then she says treats occasional. So, Pam, tell me about the green tea. Tell me about the water.
Okay. Well, let's start with water. We'll start at the bottom and we'll move our way up through the questions. So here's where my water recommendation comes in. We know that humans lose 10 cups of water a day. And how you lose it is you sweat. I mean, right now I'm sitting in my lake house and it's about 72 degrees in the house and I'm not sweating like water running down my body, but we're all sweating all day long, even though it's imperceptible. And then through talking, so that's when you go outside and it's really cold and you see the fog when you talk, that's condensation, urination and elimination with feces. So we lose 10 cups of water and you have to replace it. So it's pretty easy to replace a couple cups of it with food. Now, if you ate a whole watermelon for lunch, you could probably do the whole thing, but most of us are not going to do that. So if you take the typical person who's eating a health-promoting diet like you and I are, you'll get a couple cups of it from food, and then you have to get the rest from someplace else, and that's through drinking water. And this is very, very important, and I'll tell you a reason that surprises people a lot. The biggest reason is cardiovascular disease. In other words, it's true that athletic performance, cognitive function, and you go through anything your body does all day long, it's easier to do when you are fully hydrated. But the most dangerous thing about being dehydrated is the fact that blood plasma is made mostly of water. And so if you're dehydrated, you're basically going to end up with viscous, sticky blood, and that can increase your risk of a heart attack. One Swedish research group said that they think that one of the reasons why heart attacks happen in the morning It's not because people are stressed about going to work. It's because it is the most dehydrated they are all day. In other words, if you go to bed dehydrated and you don't drink anything all night long, when you get up in the morning, you're the most dehydrated. Your blood is the most sticky and viscous, and that makes it more likely that you could develop a clot and have a heart attack. So that's why it's important to drink water. And if you talk to anybody who works in an ER, any friend of you of yours who's a physician, they'll tell you that people show up in the emergency room brought there by the squad who are dehydrated all day long. So one thing that people will say is, well, you know, you don't have to measure your water, just drink when you're thirsty. Well, I think that if that worked out pretty well, we wouldn't see all these people passed out in the squad heading for the ER. Obviously, they were severely dehydrated, and if they'd felt uncomfortable enough to drink, they would have done something about it. So you have to consciously drink the water, whether you're thirsty or not. And by the way, as we age, our thirst sensation diminishes some anyway. And that's one of those things. There are things that happen as you age, and that's one of them, and we can't do a whole lot about that.
Well, and I have a personal anecdote from a friend who had a small stroke very early, much too ahead of his time. And it turned out that it was on a day when he was working, although indoors, to an extent that he got dehydrated and actually gave his drink to somebody else who was working with him. And and so didn't even have what he usually carried with him. And he ended up with a small stroke that day. So, you know, that's just a little anecdote about it that rings true
to me. But it goes to the point. And most people will tell you they know somebody who's had a problem with dehydration, either a high school football player who, you know, in the dog days of August, you know, faints and has to be taken to the ER during football practice, or it happened to my own dad. You know, my father's pretty diligent. He's 86 and takes no drugs, but he got a little sloppy with the water drinking, and you know, sometimes when I nag him about stuff, he just, right, and he doesn't listen. So he passed out from dehydration. Now, my father hates the hospitals, and he doesn't want medical intervention. He learned his lesson so much. He's never done. He comes in every day waving his water bottle at the office. But my own dad passed out from dehydration because he got sloppy with the water drinking.
Okay. Next one up, I think, was the green tea.
Yeah. So one thing I always tell people is there's no magical food. You know, people always say, well, what do I eat if I need to get more iron in? What do I eat if I need to get calcium? There's no combination of plant foods, if you do this right, following that pyramid and exactly the order that you went through it, that isn't going to provide you with enough nutrients. However, the green tea is a bit of an exception to the rule. The Chinese and the Asians have been consuming it for thousands of years, and as it turns out, there's some reasons why. It is one of the most antioxidant-rich foods that you can possibly consume. And let me tell you the extent to which it's been written about and that sort of thing. There are over 1,800 articles posted in PubMed about one antioxidant in green tea, EGCG, and cancer. Just that nutrient in that topic, all right? I just taught a course on cancer this summer and did a lot of research on that and many other things. And so there's a good reason why the Chinese have been drinking 6 cups of it a day for a long time. We're not tea drinkers here, and so we use it as a food. We actually grow our own green tea in China. We own our own farms there. And we grow it to be consumed like a food. And when you were at my house during your last visit, remember we made those smoothies that had the green tea in it as a food to consume. And you get the most antioxidant value from consuming it as a food. So that's why the green tea is there. It's a bit of an exception to the magical food rule.
So could I buy a box of green tea right from your own Chinese farms from you?
Yeah.
And
yes,
then what
we
can
have
I
it
do?
In Columbus.
Sprinkle it on. It's not for making tea, right? It's a food.
Well, you can. It's just really it's expensive for that, and you get more out of it if you just eat it as a food. So we tell people put it in a smoothie, and that way it has a pretty strong taste. That way you won't even notice it, because I think you've found that smoothie to be pretty fruity. Like you didn't taste all the other stuff I put in it.
Right.
You did not taste the beet powder, the spinach powder, the green tea, all that stuff that was in there. It tasted like bananas and berries, and that's the whole idea.
Okay. Now, What was my third question?
Fat. Talking about fat and oil.
Oh, yes. Oh, God. I'm so glad. I couldn't read my writing here. And, is fat simply, no matter what it is, what kind of fat it is it all inflammatory? Because I think cutting out fat was to a great extent, a very big deal for me. I mean, I read the labels now, and I go for the lowest fat I can, or no fat. The dressings I use are no fat, zero fat, mm-hmm. and then I put on my salads and so on. And I think that's played a big role. And so what are we doing? Are we actually getting rid of an inflammatory agent out of our bodies if we don't eat that much fat?
It's everything. Let me tell you what the problem with fat is. The first thing is that nobody gets healthy or lean by counting calories. None of us do it well. I mean, I couldn't tell you the calorie count in my dinner last night without weighing the green beans. And I mean, people just don't live that way. So, but having said that, you have to have some consciousness about calories. So let's talk about oil for just a second. A tablespoon of oil has 120 calories and 14 grams of fat. Just think about that. Now, if you've seen me, I'm 5'7", I weigh about 120, 121 pounds. If I were to add 3 tablespoons of an olive oil-based salad dressing to my diet every day and not change anything, I don't know what the heck I changed. I eat pretty well. I exercise every day. So what are we going to do differently? I gained 37 pounds in a year. So you have to have consciousness about fat. Fat makes you fat. And that is actually how the inflammatory effect occurs, because your fat cells pump out inflammatory cytokines, and that's the connection between obesity and overweight and every disease. Every disease state involves inflammation, and the more fat cells you have, the more pounds you carry of fat, the higher your inflammation level is going to be. So that's problem number one. Fat makes you fat, and if you're fat, any overweight that you carry, that increases your inflammation level. But some people listen to me talk and they say, well, you know, I hear what you're saying, but I eat olive oil and I'm skinny. I don't have any problem with that. Well, you might be getting away with it from a weight perspective, but here's the problem. We know, we now have the technology to take apart atherosclerotic plaques, you know, those plaques that rupture and cause heart attacks. And of course, nobody's shocked at this. There's plenty of saturated fat, but there's also a lot of mono and polyunsaturated fat. So people have been told it's not how much fat you eat, it's the type of fat you eat. That's really not true. It's how much. And fat is fat to a certain extent. So, again, going back to our Okinawans, who are some of the longest-lived people in the world, the adult Okinawan eats a diet that's 9% of calories from fat. In the United States, it's an average of 40. That's a big difference. Well, that's why we're a lot sicker than the Okinawans. So that's a big problem. And by the way, the idea of just swapping things out, it's the same thing with animal food. You know, people say, well, I don't eat any beef. I eat chicken and fish. Well, I have news for you. If you eat as much chicken and fish as you used to eat beef, you're probably still going to have a heart attack or get cancer or get diabetes or gain weight or something bad will happen if you do it long enough. So the idea that you keep your diet the same and you just swap out the type of food is one of the reasons why people have trouble doing this on their own. They'll usually keep their diet the same and just swap the foods, and then they don't really get any better. But, you know, it doesn't work with fat. It doesn't work with animal foods either.
Well, that's very, very clear. Folks, if you start really moving in this direction and read up the details from Pam, you can also call Pam for a consultation. And, you know, I often point out the good therapists that are on, and so I don't mind also pointing out the great nutritionist that's on, and that she does consultations. But I'm pretty sure that just about anybody that moves in the direction of this diet, the further you move in the direction, the more you're going to be surprised at how much better you feel. And even specific organic problems will improve. And it's not magic. It's just that you're eating the way human beings were intended. We weren't intended to eat all this fat and all this dairy. Oh, talk a little bit about why dairy is so bad. I've talked some about it. Add some of your knowledge to that.
Yeah, here's the thing. Humans are designed to eat, to be breastfed and then weaned. And that's pretty much the way it is with all mammals. And mammals' milk is real specific to the growth pattern of the particular mammal. So there's a very specific nutritional makeup for cow's milk and for goat's milk and sheep's milk and human milk and, panda bear milk and all that sort of thing. So the milk of one species is not very appropriate for another. So just by way of example, if you don't breastfeed your baby, and I think Jeannie Stolze will have a lot to say about this, but if you don't breastfeed your baby and you use formula instead, if you use a cow's milk formula, they have to dilute it by half because the protein load is so high, it will blow out the child's kidneys within 72 hours. And that's why they have to add corn syrup and all kinds of garbage to the formula to make it appropriate for humans, because it's really not a very good food for humans. I mean, think about it. Humans are born at 6 to 8 pounds, and in 18 years, they grow to 100 to 200 pounds, and a cow is born at 90 pounds, and in a year or so, weighs 900 pounds. So you can see the difference in growth factors. So because it's an inappropriate food for humans, dairy causes a lot of health issues, and starting with children, it's one of the leading causes of juvenile diabetes. It is a leading cause of constipation, ear infections, chronic infections of all types, allergies, asthma, osteoporosis, multiple sclerosis, autoimmune diseases, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, prostate cancer. And on the prostate cancer issue, the risk that a man who consumes a couple servings a day of dairy will develop prostate cancer is higher than the risk that a smoker will develop lung cancer. So this is really bad stuff. It's just not appropriate for humans. And by the way, this idea that people are so resistant to, that there's an appropriate diet for all species, it really is true. You know, my cat, you met Schroeder when you were at my house, he's a carnivore. So if I fed him the sweet potato, big salads, tomato soup diet that you and I are eating, he would develop fatty liver disease and die within less than a couple of weeks. He's a carnivore. But humans, it takes longer to kill an adult human. So an adult human who's living on a diet like Schroeder kills himself or herself much more slowly, but nevertheless does it.
As a part of all this, you're clearly not one of these high-protein bar folks. I mean, it's so interesting to see. I used to have these protein bars. They were advertised as being so healthy, and now I look at them, and my God, they're not just high protein; they're all high fat, and at least the ones I've seen. And talk about the high protein, because people get really stuck on that. The humans need protein; it's the only thing, the only food element they must have. They can do without fat or carbs. They can't live without protein. All these different things about high protein being a good thing.
We could do a whole show on this, but I'll tell you what I think happened that got everybody sideways about protein is it was the first nutrient that was ever discovered. So if you discover a nutrient, it's the only one you know about, and you don't know there are going to be 100,000 more, you can think your discovery is a lot more important than it really is. And I think that's what happened to Gerhard Walder back in the early 1800s. But here's the thing with protein. Adult humans' protein needs are about 2.5% of calories. And how we know that is that when protein is broken down and used, you have to release nitrogen from the amino acid chains. And nitrogen throws off toxic byproducts like urea and ammonia. And so if you eat a lot of protein, you blow out your kidneys. That's one of the reasons we have such an epidemic of kidney disease in this country. But we can measure urinary nitrogen excretion, and then we know how much protein you used up, and then we know how much you have to replace, and it's about 2.5% of calories. And so this is very confusing to people, including a lot of people in the nutrition business who don't understand that the body metabolizes carbohydrate differently than protein. So the way I explain it to my patients is that carbohydrate is like gas in the car. Okay, so you fill the car with gas and you drive around, and when the car is empty, you have to go get more gas. So you fill the body with carbohydrate, and it's the energy currency that the body prefers. And when you run out of fuel, you have to have more carbohydrate. It converts to glucose, goes to the Krebs cycle. That's where you get your energy. Protein's a whole lot different. Protein's broken down into its constituent amino acids, and then those various amino acids are combined to make enzymes and hormones. And often once an enzyme performs its function, the amino acid chains are then reused. And we even have a store of endogenous protein in our gut that we can use to fill in any missing gaps. I mean, Mother Nature's built in a lot of protections for humans to keep them alive. And so the way that I explain protein is it's like the fountain downtown Columbus that has 500 gallons of water in it. They don't add 500 new gallons every day. They add 20. That's what's splashed out and evaporated because the water keeps circulating through the fountain. So the amino acid chains keep circulating through the body. And then once the amino acid chain is just worn out, then the nitrogen is released. And that's what we're measuring. And that's how we know you really don't need much protein at all. So it's very dangerous to eat a high protein diet because, as I mentioned before, you'll blow out your kidneys. As the body tries to excrete the toxic byproducts of protein metabolism, and it happens all the time. So that's why diabetics have developed kidney disease. That's one of the main contributors to kidney disease is that diabetics are told to eat a high-protein diet. And I think it's interesting that diabetics in our country are told to eat a diet that is not consumed by any population on the planet that doesn't have diabetes. Think about that for a minute. It just is astounding that this is the way things are.
It's so much like psychiatry where the drugs you take actually cause the disorder you're trying to treat.
Exactly, exactly.
I mean, over and over again, every single psychiatric drug in its label,
almost every one of them warns
it's going to make you worse or could.
Yeah, well, it is just like psychiatry because you know how the psychiatrist prescribes one drug and it doesn't work. And so they go, no problem, we'll keep you on that drug and add Abilify, right? Okay, yeah. So the endocrinologist prescribes a high-protein diet, which nobody really even knows how to do it, but they start eating all this protein, puts the person on metformin, and eventually, if you read the package insert on metformin, if you keep eating a high-protein, high-fat diet and take metformin, it basically guarantees you will become an insulin-dependent diabetic over time.
Yeah. My internist here in town, as it turns out, who's a really good internist, took us a long time to find him. He was very comfortable and not at all surprised about the success we're having on this. And that's partly because he knows some of the people in Ithaca who were at the foundation of this diet. And Campbell, I'm forgetting his first name.
Colin Campbell.
Who did the China study book and from which a lot of this began is here in town. So he was very familiar with this. Gave me a blessing on it. The one thing he was concerned about was B12, not getting enough B12 from a vegetable based diet. Even with me eating a chicken or a little fish caught in the, you know, hopefully, you know, from the ocean itself. Even doing that three times a week, he was concerned about the B12. What is there any validity to that? That's one of the things that most obviously comes up.
No. Well, let me tell you, first of all, the people who are, in my experience, I've maybe had a couple vegans in the last 21 years that have had B12 deficiencies. Most of the B12 deficiencies are diagnosed in carnivores. And one of the reasons is that your body produces a protein called intrinsic factor in the gastrointestinal tract that allows you to break down and utilize and assimilate B12. So all these people, if you turn on TV for an hour, you see 10 ads for laxatives and irritable bowel and all this kind of, everybody's got GI problems. That's a lot of what I spend my afternoons dealing with in my office. So you see more B12 deficiencies in the carnivores. Plant eaters like me used to be able to get B12 from two places. We drank groundwater. Well, we clearly can't do that now. That's a dangerous practice. And we didn't used to clean food so well. You know, right now we sterilize everything, and there's a benefit to that. I'm not saying that we should stop doing that or go back to drinking groundwater, but B12 grows on bacteria. So that's why people like me who eat an exclusively plant-based diet have to take a supplement. But if you're eating even a little bit of animal food every week, you're getting enough B12. Your B12 needs are 2.4 micrograms per day. And another thing is that even people like me who eat an exclusively plant-based diet, I have a smoothie every morning, and all of the plant milks, like almond milk and soy milk, are fortified with B12. So, and almost hysteria has grown up around this idea of B12 deficiency, which is interesting cocktail party conversation, but not so much playing out every day in doctor's offices like mine.
So plant milks, you like plant milks. Those are pretty healthy.
Well, they're a good alternative. I'm crystal clear about this. This is, people don't drink plant milk. I mean, I suggest that they don't. This is so you can have a bowl of cereal. This is so you can make a smoothie. A lot of times parents will say, okay, you scared me on the cow's milk issue, so now I'll give my child a glass of almond milk with dinner every night. Now, you want to give your child water. The sooner children, as soon as they're weaned, they start consuming water, half their weight in ounces, and they should learn that all fluids aren't sweet. That's an important early lesson to teach children, because we have an epidemic of obesity in our children today, and one of the reasons is because they like consuming sports drinks, juice, flavored milk, soft drinks, because they like sweet. And I see this in my office when I tell a child, you're going to have to start drinking water. I don't like water. It doesn't have any taste. Well, I understand that, but the reason why you're diabetic and overweight is because you like Mountain Dew and you can't really have that anymore. So it's good for parents to really get their kids drinking water. So you use the plant milks to do things, like I said, cereal and smoothies.
Well, most cereals are processed food. I mean, what if you eat Cheerios? Is that pretty good, or Corn Flakes,
okay,
or something? As long as it's not too fatty on the label.
Well, as long as it doesn't have 25 ingredients. I mean, you pick up your average General Mills cereal, and the ingredients list, you have to stop in the aisle for 15 minutes and read it. There's so many things. So a minimally processed cereal is fine, and I caution health professionals who want to do the type of work that I do, which involves a lot more than nutrition, but nutrition is the centerpiece of it, not to start prescribing diets that are so restrictive that nobody sticks with it, and then that sort of is defeating, right? So a little bit of processed food is fine. I mean, I like toast, and I like cereal once in a while, and I like pasta. But the reason we use that pyramid diagram that you were referring to earlier is because it's really clear if you eat from that pyramid, you can evaluate yourself and say, gosh, I'm eating more pasta and cereal than I am potatoes, squash, and vegetables. I probably need to shift this around a little bit because I really should be living more on whole foods.
Is there a cereal that's a whole food?
Yeah, well, you're going to have things added to cereal to make it taste good. So, for example, we make a cereal that's sweetened with a little bit of maple syrup. That makes you want to eat it. The grains are whole. I mean, it's whole oats and whole triticale, and, you know, I can't remember what's in it. We have a couple different cereals. So, yeah, there are some whole grain cereals, but they might have a little sweetener or something added, and that's okay. Again, minimally processed food or something that's been sweetened a little bit, that's not what's causing our disease. What's causing all of our epidemic of disease is high protein, high fat, high animal food, oils, dairy, and the ridiculously high processed foods that you can read labels in the grocery store. I'm sure you've seen this, where there's no food in it. It's a bottle of stuff or a jar of stuff or a box of stuff, and you look at it, and there's not even any food in it. It's just all chemicals. Well, you know, it's hard to, just like you can't operate your car without putting the right fuel in it, it's hard to operate a body when you're feeding it Yellow Lake number 5 and 7 kinds of sugar.
Pam, we got to wrap up. I'm getting the signal here. I think
this
has been
one
of the most educational hours I've ever had. I hope it is also for many of you. Folks,
thank you.
It's so educational. November 9th, Columbus, Ohio. In the afternoon, it begins with a workshop by Eileen, a wonderful PT who has actually done a lot for my pain. And then the conference just goes on, and it's a wonderful conference. Look it up. Stay in touch. We'll be telling you more about it. Look up Pam Popper and go and check out my continuing blog series with blog number 3 on Michelle Carter, the young girl who was on psych drugs. Her boyfriend who killed himself was on psych drugs. The boyfriend had just was tormented. Michelle had medical problems, but they're going to blame the boy's suicide on Michelle to cover up psych drugs, to cover up what abuse actually does to people, that they just to cover up all that matters and to further this shutdown on free speech that's going on in the country today. Hey, thanks, folks. Thank you, Pam Popper. I love you.
Thank you. I love you too. Bye.
Bye.